Hello, in this audio snippet, we would like to finish talking about both Jim Brown and Tina Turner, who have passed away recently, and about whom we have been talking in the last couple of audio snippets. And would like to talk about them together because I think that their combined passing or death in these last few days is they both point to a combined message of where we are now and what we will be facing in the days ahead as America descends into its death in less than 4 months. One thing that I did want to point out, and it's a thought that hit me the other day, like a ton of bricks, I hadn't realized that. And it's that we've been always talking about how Black people have always had this calling to be the people in the watchtower, to be the discerner of the seasons, the ones pointing out what is coming in the horizon, what the atmosphere is turning into. To give us a warning, you know, like a person on the watchtower looking out, seeing what's coming and warning the people in the city. But Black people have failed to do that. But it is interesting to me that I realized, you know, Jim Brown passed away on May 19th. And we spoke about how that date was very symbolic and very significant. And I knew it was very, very significant. And then maybe a week or so before or more before May 24th, I became aware of that specific date and that date was also very significant. And it involved, in my case, something particular in my personal life, you could say. But it was... It was a peculiar thing and something that I never expected would happen, a situation that I never expected would happen. The thing is that those dates were relevant and they both, you know, left the world on those particular days. So it is as if by their deaths or their passing, they announced to the world, there's a relevance to this date, and there's a significance associated with it. In a sense, these two people who are, you know, happen to be Black, were acting out as announcers of things through their deaths. So they were, in a sense, fulfilling the watchtower calling of Black people. By letting us know, hey, you know, pay attention. This date is important. There is something relevant here. On May 19th, we crossed into what we said before, a dark cloud. There used to be a dark cloud over the country already, but it was not tangible. It's not visible. It was there. You could feel it, but you couldn't quite see it. And then on May 19th, it's as if the cloud became visible. It's like now we can see it. It's over the country and it's dark and it and there's no denying it. You look up at the sky and it's dark. It's cloudy and dark. So things are going to get worse. We crossed a certain threshold that day. And then on May 24th, also had another important date. That was the date that conservatives turned their back full time to the truth. I mean, deliberately, because in a sense, they have ignored the truth. It's like they know it's there. They listen to part of it, part of what the truth has to say. But other than that, they just kind of pretend like it. The truth is not there. But it's as if on May 24th, they said, oh no, we are doubling down because they are convinced that what they need is more more enthusiasm, more determination to win, to defeat the liberals and take back the country and so forth. So they made the determination to turn their back on anything that is not conservatism. And on that day, on May 24th, it's as if I could see them turning their, all of them, deliberately turning their backs to the truth and to anyone speaking the truth. And said, we are against you. And they became this like this blockade of backs, like a dam saying the river shall not pass here. And that's why Tina Turner passed away that day. As we explained before, Tina is apparently related to the word, is derived from river in some way. And so they decided to turn the river of truth back. Like, we're putting up a dam, and we will not let the river of truth flow through our land. And so that was a very significant, sad and significant day. A couple of things we wanted to mention about Tina Turner that we had already kind of briefly mentioned before, is that as she grew older, she began to kind of do a mixture of her baptism or Baptist upbringing with Buddhism. So she became a Buddhist Baptist, and that's how she kind of described herself. A lot of conservative Christians would go, yeah, that's a sign that she's of the devil or whatever. The thing is that there's a more nuanced reality to that. And it's that the problem is she grew up in an environment, a Baptist environment. And the Baptist denomination is very limited in its thinking. It's very tied up in tradition and boundaries. It doesn't grow. It's very stagnant. And in a sense, it is a symbol of conservatism. That's what conservatism is. It's the stagnant pool of water that hasn't moved for decades. And anyone who stirs the waters is immediately shut down. And that's kind of, in a wider sense, the state of the entire American Christian church, tied up in its matriarchal system. And not because women are running the show, literal women, but figurative women are running the show. And we more or less talked about that a little bit in the past. The thing is that it's tied in this matriarchal set system, and it refuses to break out of it. And the worthless sons of bitches, the pastors, the worthless bastards who run the American Christian church are unwilling to listen to the truth. Worthless little bastard boys, all of them have decided we are not going to break or destroy the matriarchal system because it's convenient to us. And then you have below that a whole bunch of sheep who are unwilling to break out of that system. They are happy in it. It is comfortable. And yes, they like to listen to different things, to deeper truths or whatever, but as long as it entertains them to a certain level. But once they are confronted with, okay, are you going to break out of the system or not? And they go, no, we don't want to break out of the system. We are okay with it. We want to work within the system. We love the system. It's okay, but you know, we can't take it too far. We can't go beyond a certain point. And because of that, they remain under the system, and they bolster the system. The system remains alive because of that. As we shared it in one of the postings, I could be wrong, but I vaguely remember a posting where we talk about that on the website where we post these recordings. We talk about how there is this groundswell of support. It's certain people are lifted up to positions of power and control by the groundswell of support. There is a kind of a subtle or implicit approval of of the system and the people running it, and that's what keeps the system alive and keeps those people in power. And that's what you have within the matriarchal system. And if I'm not mistaken, I could be wrong on this, but I believe that in that same posting, and I could be wrong, that in that posting, we actually quote Tina Turner and her song, Beyond the Thunderdome, I think is the name of the song, a song from 1984. I think it was in a Mad Max film or something. But it's one personally one of my favorite songs. And it said, and someone sent an email the other day pointing that out. The song says, we don't need another hero. We don't need to, I forget what else it says. And then it says, all we want is life beyond the Thunderdome. And so it's interesting that it's in, and I could be wrong, I believe it's in that posting where we talk about that. And we don't need another hero means we don't need to lift up another person that we can hero worship to save us and lead us out of our situation. You know, we want to just be free to expand ourselves. We want to live beyond the Thunderdome, and the Thunderdome is a figure of a place where you're under this covering, and this covering keeps you under oppression and keeps thundering over you, because it's saying, you know, you shall submit to our ways of thinking, and you have no freedom to think on your own. And we will punish you if you dare to go beyond certain limits and dare to explore, to find truth, to see truth as ever expanding, and eternal and infinite and powerful. You live under this Thunderdome, and the song is about, you know, living, going beyond that Thunderdome, and not just looking for some hero of this cult, you know, this cult of personality that we sometimes have. We just want somebody, some hero, to come and rescue us, because it's too much hard work to do it ourselves. You know, that kind of thinking. That's what the church, the American church, is filled with people who would just want another hero. And the conservative movement, in a certain sense, is also doing that. They want another hero. And their hero right now is Trump. You know, the feisty guy who's doing this, that, the other. And he's turned out to be a pathetic little failure. Just to give you an example, this past week, the debt ceiling controversy that happens every year was resolved. I knew it was going to get resolved. You know, I had no concern that the government was going to default, because they always come to an agreement. And this time it was even worse than before, because they decided to just drop the debt ceiling for 4 years. And in a sense, there is a certain kind of like acceptance of reality to that, because the debt ceiling is just there for show. Because every time we get near the debt ceiling, all we do is raise it. You know, it's like you have a credit card, and you have a limit, and whenever you reach the limit, imagine the credit card company saying, okay, we'll just raise your limit, $5,000 more. You know, so then you go up to that new limit the next year, and they just keep giving you more and more money to more limit on your credit card. That's the lunacy of the system we're in. And the thing is that they just decided we'll not have any debt limits, so that means that now the debt will just increase as much as needed. And I say needed in quotes. And this was promoted by this son of a bitch, Jim McCarthy, the so-called Speaker of the House, with the resident of the White House, the horsident, White House resident, horsident, and they decided, they made an agreement, and it was passed, and The House approved it, the Senate approved it immediately, and it's done. So, and I know that is the groundwork for the destruction of the country. The economy is going to die, you know, with over the years. This was kind of like the seminal, it was a seminal moment. It was a milestone moment in American history, economic history, that, okay, the decline of the economy will be cemented today. Boom. And that deal was established, and it's going to lead to the eventual collapse of what used to be the greatest economy on Earth. But the thing is that this was done by McCarthy, the son of a bitch that Trump kept trying to use, that kept supporting when there was this controversy, this fight in the House to elect a speaker. And as we've said before, the whole system of having a speaker, a hero, somebody, you know, of a higher level who leads the troops in the House is ridiculous. It should be every individual having the same power. These blood clots, these the power clots that we talked about in previous audio clips, should not exist, but they were put into the system by the idiot founding fathers and their idiotic constitutional framework. They put these people there, and now you have the power concentrating in one individual. Why should it matter what Joe McCarthy or Kevin McCarthy, I don't know why I just called him Joe McCarthy, interesting. Maybe, you know, it's kind of like a mixture of Joe Bite Me and his name. And I think there was another McCarthy, the one who was accusing people of being communists back in the 50s. I forget what his name was. But the thing is that this McCarthy fellow, why does it matter what he thinks? It should matter what everybody thinks. If people were unhappy with the bill, why couldn't anyone else in the House propose a bill and say, okay, we don't like that. That is evil. Let's do this and let's pass it in the House. Have the House have the freedom to do that. But one of the reasons why they can't do that is because to do a budget bill is like writing like five gazillion pages. And we've explained before, that is another problem with our system, that bills should never be more than a certain number of pages. And, you know, the number is debatable, but I would dare say the number would be around 10, 20, or maybe even 50 pages, but 50 is, I think it's going a little bit too far. And if you need something to, if the bill covers too much, then you have to split it into multiple bills. And that's how you pass each bill, because it's ridiculous. No one can read 5,000 pages of budget. No one can do that. It's just too much. It's ridiculous. It should be bill by bill, 20 pages or 50 pages at a time. I'd say 20. 50 sounds like too much. 20, you know, letter or A4, whatever size pages in normal font, you know, not the tiny print just to make it fit 20 pages. But it should be readable in 20 pages and passed. So everything should be done like that. Instead of building this behemoth of a bill that has a million things and has a whole lot of pork inserted into it, so they just insert a little bit of pork here, a little bit of pork there, pork here, pork there, pork everywhere. It gets to the point where if you hate the pork and you vote against the bill, you bring down the whole budget, and then there is no budget, and then all hell breaks loose, and then everybody complains, and then the Social Security checks, and everybody complains about the poor dying of hunger and blah blah blah. But if we had the bills set up individually, then in 20 pages at a time, then we could pass a bill on a specific thing, 20 pages, boom, and then another bill. And, oh, that'd be too many bills. Well, what the hell are these people there for? We pay them to be voting all day, you know, so it's their job, and they should be doing it throughout the year. It takes so much effort. They should have been, you know, planning the budget all along, passing the bills, you know, with time. But aside from all of that, all of that just evidences there's something wrong with the system, but no one sees it. No one complains about it. I have not heard a single person voice the things that we're saying right now. Not a single person. All the conservatives are angry at McCarthy for caving to bite me. Yeah, and rightfully so. But the thing is, why do we have to have a strong Speaker of the House with convictions? And if he does not have convictions, we're all doomed. Why? Why do we need a system like that? And why do we need to have pass a budget that is, it must be thousands and thousands of pages long with a whole bunch of pork in it. So no one looks at these things. They just don't care. Because to them, we just need to maintain the system we had before, back in the 40s or 50s and 60s, when life was good and we were still the great American nation. Let's make America great again. Let's go back to the past. That's what the word again there emphasizes. Let's make America great again. Let's go back to the past because the past worked and we just need to go back to that. So there is no understanding that we are here now because of where we were in the past. It's like this downhill slope, and we get all the way to the bottom of this very slippery slope, and this, we just need to get back to the top, because that way we'll stay on the top without realizing. You go back to the top, you'll slide all the way back down again, if you ever were able to get back to the top. But there is no way, because the slope is so slippery, you can't climb up it. It's too crooked. We need to go somewhere else. This slope does not work. It's not a slope. Yes, it is a slope. Look at where we are now. Oh, that's because of the evil people that are doing this. Well, the evil people are doing this because they were enabled by the system. There was a vacuum, and they filled it. And we never filled it, so they filled it for us. And as long as we don't accept the full truth, they will keep filling it for us, even if we were able to kind of wipe them off the face of the earth and go back to the way we were. They will come back like cockroaches. And do it all over again. But we don't get any of that. But regardless, the thing is, what I wanted to say is Kevin McCarthy was supported by Trump. And when the Republicans, the new Republicans who were more like emboldened, were trying to get someone else who was not a sellout and a rhino and a piece of Irish Celtic trash, they decided to, when all of that was happening, instead of Trump saying, okay, yeah, we need to fight for something new, for principle. We just can't work with the system and the people and the trashy people in the system. Instead of that, he kept trying to get everybody to support McCarthy. McCarthy, the guy who had turned his back on him. And suddenly, well, and you know why he was doing that? Because Trump was doing the art of the deal. He was trying to garner support within the Republican establishment. He needed McCarthy to kind of be a little bit on his side, and he wanted to show the Republican machinery that he liked. He was willing to play within the system and support their people, so that hopefully someday they would then support him on his things. And that will never happen. But Trump is an idiot. He doesn't understand that. He thinks he's still going back to his old thinking. I have been successful as a businessman doing this, so I'm going to apply these things here. And yes, some of those ideas may have worked for him in the business world, but to a certain extent. But they can't be applied to politics or to the reality of the nation. You just can't deal your way out of everything. There are certain things you can do deals with when you're buying and selling stuff or whatever. But if you live by that principle, then you're going to be a failure as a person. And that's why he is out of the White House. And that's why he got duped out of the White House. That's why the election was taken from him and all that. So he is a failure. Now that everybody's angry at Kevin McCarthy, I look at the comments, condemning him, and no one, I don't hear anyone bring up the comment about the fact that Trump supported this guy. So, But they keep propping up Trump and, oh yeah, he's our hero. He's going to take us back to the promised land. It's ironic. It's as if the American conservatives think that we entered the promised land and we got kicked out of the promised land. I mean, that's how retarded their thinking is. We were never in the promised land. We never crossed the Jordan. That's what the truth kept prompting us to do, to cross the Jordan, to go beyond, go to the other side, and we never wanted to. And that's why we are where we are right now. So we are trying to find a hero that will take us to that land, and there isn't a hero, not in that way. And the people who are the real heroes are the ones who are being discarded and ignored. But those heroes that are being discarded are the ones who would enable everybody else to be heroes too. But that's too much responsibility, I guess. So people don't want to live by that. So the thing is that Tina Turner, when she went into Buddhism, it's because she was living in this very limited scope. And because the church, the American church, didn't grow, it's as if she felt the need to go somewhere else to find that growth. And that's why, unfortunately, she turned to Buddhism and things like that. And the group that she had in Switzerland, we shared before, was called Beyond. You know, she formed this small group with some neighbors over there in Switzerland, and she called it Beyond. And that is... precisely that. It's her longing to go beyond the Thunderdome, beyond the limitations to grow into a new face. So I don't see what happened to her as so much as an indictment against her, but more as an indictment against the American church that never grew, that never expanded, that never went beyond its limited understanding of the world. And that's why we mentioned before how that article by this very well-meaning guy that I think personally I would like. I think he seems very likable, J.D. Rucker. But, it's so sad that his article was about how we need to go back to the priorities of old, faith, family, and country in that order. So it's like, okay, we need, instead of looking at the situation and saying we are about to die, we need to there's something we're not doing right. All we do is go back like a dog to his vomit, to the past, to the formulas of the past that have no foundation, no metaphysical foundation. We spoke about how that faith, family, country paradigm is, and the Christians are always the ones who say that. The American conservative Christians, always the ones saying that. And it has no backing even in their own Bible. The Bible that they claim to believe in is contrary to to that whole statement. We spoke about how faith, for example, is used more as an emotional crutch instead of being pointing to the object of their faith. Instead of pointing to the God they claim to believe in, it points inward to themselves and it's just a way to, like, oh yeah, faith through hard times, oh, let's be strong and courageous. Our faith will lead us through, that sort of thing. When you read Psalm 23, the famous Psalm, it doesn't say my faith took me through the valley of the shadow of death. It doesn't say that, right? It doesn't say, that my faith protected me and guided me through the dark times. No, it's not your faith, you idiot. It's supposed to be the object of your faith. There are passages in your Bible, conservative Christian, where it says your faith has healed you. Faith is an active force, but it's at the end of the day, is faith in what? I mean, if you have faith in a chia pet, I don't know why I'm thinking of that, But if you have a chia pet and you say, oh, I have faith in it, it will guide me through my dark times, you know, and whenever you feel down, you stand in front of your chia pet and you look at it and you go, oh, yes, I feel better now and I will make it through the hard times. You know, yes, your faith, you're using it as an emotional crutch, you're sustaining you, but the object of your faith is a powerless chia pet. And so it's faith is an active force, but the faith, you know, the important thing is, what do you have faith in? If you have faith in the wrong thing, it's not going to take you anywhere. But these people don't think that way, so they're just going back to this old, doubling down. That's what they're doing, and that's when Tina Turner passed away. It was a symbol of the conservative movement has decided today to double down on their stupidity. They've turned their back on the truth, and they're going to build a dam to hold back the river of truth from America permanently. Without realizing that's the truth, that's the river that would have saved them and the country. But they don't want that. You know, it's like the Jews, like in the Bible, it says they were given a choice, Barabbas or Jesus, and they shouted, Barabbas, Barabbas, and let the blood of the other guy be on us if we were wrong. And we know what happened afterwards. It didn't turn out, things didn't go too well with the Jewish people after that. And so the thing is that that's what Tina Turner represents, you know, that river of truth that was turned back on that day. And she kept wanting to go beyond, and the American church, the American culture, the American system just was not conducive to it. And you have to take into account when she decided to renounce her citizenship in 2000, it was 2013. And you think about it, 2013, you know, who was in the White House in 2013? It was not some, you know, radical conservative, right-wing conservative. It was not Trump. Trump was not there yet. In 2013, it was Obastor, the Kenyan son of a bitch, imposter, who America stupidly voted for. That was the guy in the White House when she said, I no longer want to be an American. That doesn't mean that she did it because of Obastor, but it's interesting that she did it when Obastor was in the White House. It's as if to say, yes, you know, when we allowed that worthless monster to get into the White House, we began the final stages of the death of the country's calling. As we have said a million times before, on the 5th of November, 2008, the day, the morning after the elections, when it was official that the son of a bitch had won, that was the day that the American Republic died. The American Republic established by the Founding Fathers, because we had been given time and time and time to kind of renew the Republic, you know, and transition in a very seamless way from the old ways to the new way. We were given time. We were given, starting from, I would say, 1998, we began this process where we were given the opportunity to make this swap, the seamless swap from the old republic to the new republic, from the old constitution, and then begin to morph into the new American constitution that we've been talking about in these audio snippets, but we refuse to do so. So in 2008, boom, it's like, okay, it's as if the truth said, you don't want to get rid of the past, I'll kill the past for you. So it's the American Republic was killed on that day, the day that the country voted for Barabbas, and then we began a process of a very, very violent, you could say, or very tumultuous process, and we were still given the chance to build the new republic, but we now had to do it with the old republic rotting because the old republic has been, it's a corpse. It's been rotting since 2008, and it stinks to high heaven. I mean, it's been 15 years stinking to high heaven. It's a huge corpse. Imagine a humongous corpse that expands for miles and miles. It's a humongous cadaver, and it's stinking to high heaven. It's been stinking for 15 years. And we were still allowed the opportunity to replace it and bury, properly bury it and start a new republic. But we had to do it with the stench in the air. And the stench got worse and worse. And instead of saying, okay, we have to bury this guy, you know, we have to say goodbye to yesterday. We have to, you know, say goodbye to the founding fathers and our worship of the Constitution and look to the truth and to a new reality, to the real reality that the founding fathers never saw. They were too clouded to see it. But instead of that, no, we doubled down and said, no, we will remain in the past. We don't want to go beyond the Thunderdome. We need another hero. We need Trump back in 2024. And it's interesting, therefore, that on that day, on that same day, when I was in that place that I never expected to be, to be frank, it was a peculiar place. I mean, if I told you the details, you would not find it that interesting. But because of my personal life, it was a very peculiar moment. When I was there, there was this television screen, and that's where I saw. I looked up and saw the headline. You know, it was muted, but I saw the headline: Tina Turner has passed away. And I was shocked by it. It was, I don't know why I was shocked by it. And then a little while later, I looked up and the other headline was DeSantis announces his presidential, campaign. So he announced on the day that Tina Turner died, which is kind of, interesting to me. And the thing is that on that day, you know, he had this big Twitter launch, on Twitter with Elon Musk and something to that effect. And apparently the Twitter launch didn't really go too well. Because that Twitter meeting hall or whatever it's called, gathering zone, I forget the name of it, was kind of like a beta functionality that Twitter never really fully developed. So it was really not equipped to handle beyond a certain number of people. So when a certain number of people joined that went beyond the threshold, they could support the thing, just blew apart. So it was the 1 hour delay, and it was a big embarrassment, and the conservatives just jumped on that. The conservatives who want Trump because DeSantis is too blasé, you know, he doesn't have the charisma and all of that Trump has. And you know, Trump is their hero, so they don't want anybody else interfering with their hero. So they began to mock him relentlessly. And it was, when I was looking at it, it's like, my goodness, you know, it's as if they were mocking a Democrat. That's how, you know, the vile behind it, the sense of sarcastic vile, and it's part of that turning their back. So they went recalcitrant, you know, like, okay, not anything that is contrary to our understanding of the world right now, even though it's proved over and over again to be a failure, we're going to we're just going to ignore it, and we're going to turn our back on it, and we are going to oppose it with every fiber of our being. So it's interesting that on that day, you know, and that incident was a way to kind of test the hearts of the conservatives and to show how vile these people are, have become, and they're going to become even more vile. So just like the liberals have been vile all this time, the conservatives on their side are going to turn more and more vile, but towards the truth, the people who speak of that truth that goes beyond their current understanding. And the other thing also that's interesting to note is that you know, the Tina Turner is famous for having been married to Ike Turner, and I believe that's where she got her surname, Turner. Yeah, that obviously, because her maiden name was, I forget what it was, but Oh, it was Bullock, just like Sandra Bullock. Obviously, no relation, I would dare say. But yeah, her name was Anna Mae Bullock. So she got her name Turner, and she kept it despite all the troubles that they had between the two of them. But it's interesting that his name was Ike, because Ike, as you know, is the nickname for Eisenhower, who happened to be a Republican president. And that's I hope you see what I'm trying to say here. It's as if the conservatives are going to, on that day, decided to turn violent. There's some violence in them now that was not there before against the truth. Just like Ike Turner turned violent on Tina Turner, and Ike, the name Ike is, the name of a Republican president, and the fact that it's Ike, Ike is a short for Eisenhower. I don't know how they got Ike from Eisenhower. But that's what they called him, and it's as if to represent, conservatism reduced to a simple understanding of the truth, because that's what conservatism is, and a simplistic understanding of the truth. So instead of saying Eisenhower, that's a very long-winded name. It's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It's 10 letters. That's a whole bunch of letters. So oh, it's too much work. So let's just reduce it to 3, because our brains are too limited and to go beyond 3 or 4 letters. So let's just call him Ike, and that's what he represents. It's a conservatism that just boils down to simplicity: faith, family, country. Don't talk to me about anything else, and that's all it is. And so that's what he represents. And it's significant because that's what happened that day. The conservatives who like to do this simplifying decided we are going to turn violent. We're going to turn our backs to the truth, and we are going to come after anyone who does not completely side with us. So that's why they started mocking DeSantis on that very day, and that's the day he decided to run. And just by the way, just so you know, I would choose DeSantis over Trump any day, but I am no fan of DeSantis. And now, I mean, to be frank, who gives a damn who wins in 2024? Pardon my French, but that's just the reality. The country's gonna be dead by then. Who cares who wins in 2024? To me, it just doesn't matter. So even if DeSantis won, what would we gain from that? Maybe a few more months or years of for the good people to get out of this country, to for the to prevent the economy collapsing completely, some of us being able to get out of here. For the ones who are called to get out of here, everybody is different. But in my personal case, I know I have to get out of this country, and I have to renounce my citizenship at some point, and disconnect myself from this country, because this country is going to be a third world country. I don't want to be associated to a third world country. I don't want that, and I want to live in a third world country, and that's what it's going to become in less than 4 months. So maybe DeSantis, if he ever made it to the White House, would serve as a way to just hold off the destruction, so that we, can prepare and some of us, make our way out of the country. But other than that, it really does not matter. And he is, I've listened to him. He is boring as. I the word came, the came the phrase that came to me is milquetoast. I'm not sure why, but it's boring. The dude is boring, and he is he's a manager. He would be a very good manager at Wendy's. That sort of person, the type of person who would be the manager at Wendy's and make it run beautifully, and all the tables would be clean, and you know the all the transactions would be recorded properly, and there'd never be any money missing, and the menu would always be pristine, and there'd always be enough of every ingredient to make the hamburgers and all that. He'd be a great manager at Wendy's, but that's all he is right now. That's all he is. And I'm receiving emails about him, which is interesting. I don't know how, but somehow I got in some email listing, and now I get emails from him. I don't know how. I'm not quite sure how that happened. And I haven't, you know, I still receive them because I want to hear what he has to say. And everything that he has to say is like, I want to run the campaign differently. So he keeps talking about how he wants to run things differently in the campaign. But if you look at, and he keeps talking about his success in Florida. So he's trying to run this very traditional campaign. He thinks that, oh, you know, we just want to, he's a very practical person who believes, okay, we just need to do things, you know, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, and we'll be successful. But I look at the emails, I don't see anything new. I don't see anything like something that would, an idea. A real idea about something, anything, you know. Okay, any idea, like for example, let's end federalism. He would never do that. Or let's reduce bills to 20 or 50 pages. He'd never do that. Let's get rid of the Speaker of the White of the House and change the way bills get to the floor. Let's end the committee system. None of that. There is nothing new. He would just be a wonderful manager to manage us in our decline. That's all he would be. And he would be constantly attacked as he tries to do that, so by the Democrats. So there is nothing hopeful or wonderful about him, but he is every he represents everything Trump is not, in a limited way. It's as if when people choose between the two, they're deciding, you know, am I going to be a goat or a sheep? That sort of thing. And as I said, I am not a supporter of him, as if oh he is the one. You know, who does it doesn't matter. The country's dead. It's going to be dead in less than 4 months. You know, a billy goat could be running the in the you know be called the president of the country. It wouldn't make a difference. The country is dead. But the thing is, which one you kind of side with, if you had to pick between the two, that is a parameter to test what you are on the inside. And so that so he's not nothing exciting, but he's going to become the symbol of how vicious conservatives have become, and that's why he started his campaign on the day that Tina Turner passed away. One thing now we wanted to start talking a little bit about. Oh, and one thing also about Ike Turner. I was looking at his biography on Wikipedia, and it's kind of a very sad upbringing. He was abused as a kid, so he had all this abuse on him, and that also led to him, you know, becoming abusive towards Tina Turner later on. So it's this, you know, this all these ancestral stuff, you know, coming from the past. It's kind of a sad story. But you know, aside from that, one thing I wanted to mention about Jim Brown, now that we've talked a bit about DeSantis, is what he said in that video, that interview that he had with Brian Kilmeade that we mentioned in the audio clip when we talked about him. And and I recommend that you listen to it if you're interested, if you have time. And I think if you do a search, as online, you know, with the words maybe something like Jim Brown, interview Brian Kilmeade 2018, you're more than likely going to find the video clip of it. And Kilmeade is spelled K-I-L-M-E-A-D-E. Brian with an I, Brian Kilmeade. That's the guy who interviewed him from Fox, Fox News. And that was in 2018. I want to read some of the things that he said during that video clip. And I apologize if what I'm about to read is not verbatim, because I'm not very good at that. I was listening to the video and trying to kind of type what he was saying as he was saying it, but I missed certain things. It was just too much effort to get the exact wording, because the important thing is the basic idea. So I apologize if I don't get some of the exact words correctly. But one of the things he said in the interview, which is very interesting, he said, the greatest thing about America is that we can have our opinions and our thoughts, and we're not all perfect. So he was basically saying, you know, we have the freedom, or we should be given the freedom to have our own thinking. And so he was praising the freedom that used to exist in America. And so that's the perspective from which he speaks. He's not like the liberals who want to impose a certain ideology, like the fascist white liberal trash in this country that is constantly trying to impose a point of view on everybody. You know, you have to be okay, and not only be okay, but be proud of sodomy. People sodomizing each other, you should be proud of that. And whether you like it or not, you're going to like it. And you're going to have your children watch transvestites doing sexual gestures in front of them, and you're going to like it. Even if you don't like it, you're going to like it. You know, that sort of fascistic, the white fascist attitude of trying to impose their points of view on everybody else, and anyone who doesn't agree with them is going to be silenced and attacked and destroyed. So he is obviously not from that perspective. And then he wrote, I think Brian Kilmeade asked something about, you know, what is Trump, Trump was in the White House at the time, so he asked, what is Trump supposed to do to help black people? And then he said something like, I have my job to do. And then he said, I don't blame him or what his office can produce. And then he said, I look at what I can produce in the black community and the community at large, and all the people I can influence. And then he said something like, we should look at ourselves first before we can look at the president. So when he was asked, what can the president do for black people? His response was not, it was very interesting to me. He didn't go, okay, yeah, he should do this, he should do that, he should do the other, because that's what all black people do. You know, when they, you know, what should the country do for you? Oh, they should give us $1 million each in reparations, or $5 million, or whatever they're asking for now, and they should do this, and they should do that, and they should do the other, and they start demanding all these, the list of demands. He didn't go there. And that doesn't take away from the fact that, and we've said these things in these audio clips, that we have missed all this historical opportunities. And we will get to that if we one day finish the Black America series, when we talk about the 1876 election and everything that happened. The Republican Party had a responsibility to speak to black people and to confront black America about their cultural problems, the problems in the black culture, and to give them hope and to speak to them. But we never did that. The conservative Republicans never did that. So there was this big void, and it was filled by the Democrats. That doesn't take away from that. So if I'd been Jim Brown, I would start saying some things like that. But it's interesting to me that he didn't even want to go there. It's like, don't talk to me about what he needs to do. Let's work out what we need to do first. And then he said, he basically quoted Michael Jackson, you know, as we've said a million times, Michael Jackson said, I'm starting with the man in the mirror. I'm asking him to make a change. if you want to make the world a better place, take a look at yourself and make a change. And that's what he said. We should look at ourselves first before we can look at the president. And then Kilmeade asked him, do you think he's producing for the black community? Speaking of Trump. And he responded something like, it's very hard to produce for the black community in a certain way. That was very interesting. He said, it's very hard to produce for the black community in a certain way. And that means he's saying, we make it difficult for other people to help us. That's what he basically, translated, that's what he said. And then he said, I am part of the black community. So he was saying, first he said, it's very hard to produce for the black community, but he didn't like distance himself from the black community and say, oh, those people, they are hard, it's hard to produce for them. It's interesting how he inserted himself back into the black community and said, I bear responsibility, even though he is not part of the problem, he puts himself as part of the people to blame, which is interesting, that's what a visionary does. Then he said the black community has a responsibility regardless of what the president does. And then he said, if you have a homicide rate within your black community, then it's not the president that's creating the homicide rate. It's the black community itself that has to address it. So I don't want to just put everything on him. That's what he said. That's what Jim Brown said. So he said, first of all, translated. We have all these black people killing all these other black people. And it's not Trump, taking a gun to a black person's, temple and blowing his brains out. It's not Trump pulling the trigger, killing all these black people. It's other black people killing all these black people. It's not even white cops killing all these black people. It's black people killing all these black people. 80 to 90% of blacks murdered are murdered by other blacks. It's just the reality. And that's in a country where they're only 10 to 13% of the population. It's just probabilistically astounding. So you would expect that in a country where 85% of people are not black, that 85% of the murders would be by, of the murders of black people would happen by non-black people. If you see what I'm saying, like in a neutral environment where there, everything just happens randomly, but clearly that means there's a pattern here. There's a pattern of violence. Black people don't respect black lives. Black lives, as we said before, BLM should be called BLM Boink Battle. Black lives matter, but only if not killed by another black life. So black people don't respect black lives. So whenever a black person goes BLM, BLM, what I go inside is bull crap, bull crap, bull crap. BLM, bull crap, lots of manure. That's BLM. Bull crap, lots of manure. That's all it is. Because these same people look the other way when one black guy, gets blown, has his brains blown out by another black guy, or when there's a drive-by shooting of black thugs shooting up, some kids in some black neighborhood, and so they don't give a damn. So that's what Jim Brown said here. Then he said, I am sorry to say that the black community is not doing what we should do, and that includes myself. So he keeps putting himself back in the problem. Even though he's not part of the problem, he's not causing the problem, he wants to take the burden of assuming the responsibility for what other people are doing. And then he said, I can work hard, I can donate more money and go more places, but we have to be able as citizens to bring something that the president joins forces with and triple the effectiveness of it. So it's very interesting what he was saying. It's like saying, okay, hey, the president, probably can do something, but we have to kind of set it up for him. It's like saying, putting it in American football terms, it's like you have you could have the greatest place kicker in the history of mankind, a guy who can, hit a field goal from 60 yards away, 80% of the time. Like, he's amazing, wonderful accuracy. incredible leg strength, and so forth. But if your offense is so bad that you can never get the ball, you know, close enough to the end zone, to the other end zone, to give the guy a chance to kick a field goal, there's no way that, you know, there's no point in having the greatest field goal kicker in history. It's not his fault, you know, that he can't kick a field goal if you don't put him near the end zone for him to kick one. You see what I'm saying? That's what he's trying to say. You know, Trump can do all he wants, but if we don't set it up for him, you know, it was like saying, speaking in basketball terms, it's like saying, you know, we can have the greatest shooter in the world, but if we don't pass him the ball and set him up, you know, we don't do the pick and roll and whatever, and we don't do what we need to have him open so that he can take a good shot at the basket, you know, what's the point of him being the greatest shooter in history? So he's saying, you know, again, he said, we have to be able, as citizens, interesting, as citizens. So he's, I don't know if he realized what he was saying as he was saying it, but when he said as citizens, he was saying as individuals. So he was a man who believed in the individual. He kept saying black community, you know, the collective, whatever, but he kept saying, going back to individual responsibility, the individual. The collective is nothing more than the individuals that comprise it. It's always been the reality. That's what we've been trying to talk about in other audio clips. And the problem is when we when we cultify the collective, when we make a cult out of it, when we give it a power and a presence that is not there, when we turn it into an entity and glorify it and deify it and say we shall worship the collective, that's when the problem starts. But the reality is the collective is nothing more than the individuals that comprise it. It's all it is. And when there's more to it than that, it's because something has penetrated the collective and something intangible is moving things and creating trouble. And so the moment you start glorifying the collective, you start glorifying whatever the hell is entering the atmosphere. As a result, there's something entering, some invisible force that is real, that is gripping the collective and then controlling it. And you empower it when you glorify the collective. I hope I'm making sense with what I'm trying to say. But if we boil it down, always the individual, it always goes back to the individual. Everything we've been saying in all of these audio clips, a lot of it is, it can be boiled down to that concept, the individual, the value of and the responsibility of the individual. That's what we need to change in the legislative system. That's why we should not have these committees and the Speaker of the House and this whole political party system we've spoken about. We need to undo the political party system, because that gives so much power to elites behind the scenes. People, you know, this deal that was done by the elites behind closed doors. The political parties get together and they decide and they control what everybody thinks. We have all the system where the individual is minimized and these collectives are emboldened and glorified and strengthened and empowered. We have to have a system where every individual should have the freedom and the power to grow and have his ideas become what make them powerful. If a congressman or congresswoman comes up with bill after bill, brilliant bill after brilliant bill that gets the approval of his or her colleagues, then that's what should empower him or her and make him a prominent person. But we have to do a lot of butt kissing. If somebody wants to rise through the ranks, they have to bend over and let them be raped by someone, or go and kiss somebody's buttocks and do all these things to rise up through the ranks to get approved, to get into the right committees and blah, blah, blah. And the individual is not empowered in the system. And that's what the matriarchal system does. It promotes this dependence on the mother collective, and disenfranchises the individual. So that's why when he said to be able as citizens, that's even though he didn't maybe consciously know what he was saying, that's what he was really saying. To be able as citizens to bring something that the president joins forces with and triple the effectiveness of it. So in other words, we just can't sit back and let him do everything for us. You know, it's like black people just go limp. That's what they do. They just go limp. Oh, you have to carry us. Oh, no, just get up and walk. No, you have to carry us because we've been oppressed for 400 years and the white man doesn't want to let us be free. And no, just get up and walk, you son of a bitch. Get up and walk. No, I can't walk. You have to carry me. And then, you know, you try to drag the son of a bitch. And pardon my French, but that's what he is. And I hope you have heard when I've explained before what I mean by bitch. It's a female dog in English, and it refers to a mentality. That's the matriarchal mentality. It is a mindset. It is an attitude. It is that's what makes you a son of a bitch. So you have to carry the son of a bitch across, you know, just drag him. And the guy is heavy as hell because he eats so much. And you wonder how, you know, how he is so poor and disenfranchised when he's so incredibly fat. So you try to carry him and you may drag him, you know, 20, 30 yards, and then you're exhausted. But if the guy could just walk, and maybe we, you know, then we could help him, you know, run faster, and get to a whole bunch of places. But so he was saying we have to do something. We just can't go limp and expect everyone to carry us to where we have to go. And then Kilmeade asked him, "Is America racist?" And he answered, "Of course not." And then he said, later in that answer, I think he said, "The emancipation happened because of white people who paid a price to make it possible." So he said, okay, you have to remember that there was a civil war, and the civil war was fought mainly by white folk, you know, against white folk. And 600,000, mostly white folk, died so that eventually, you know, black people could be free. So he was kind of pointing that out. And he said, and this is where I'm probably misquoting him a lot, but in terms of literal words, but the idea hopefully stayed the same. He said something to the effect of, "All the athletes are wealthy," and he was talking about athletes in the NFL, the NBA, and so forth, Major League Baseball, and most, or a lot of them, a significant number of them, if not the vast majority of them, are black. So he said, "All the athletes are wealthy because of the white people who support those teams." And he said, and he kind of like chuckled on the inside when he said, not the non-white people. So he was basically saying, you know, white people are the ones who have the most money, and they're the ones who are going to the stadiums. It's not like these athletes are rich off of all the black Americans that go to the stadium and pay their money to support these leagues and the sport and all these sports. It's the white people," he said, who are, and he was kind of implicitly saying these white people are paying their money to watch black people play. In other words, and they're cheering for black people, and they're wearing, you know, black people's T-shirts. You know, when they carry, you know, wear the Michael Jordan shirt or whatever, they're wearing the name of a black guy on their backs. They are saying Michael Jordan, the greatest of all time. They're saying a black guy, the greatest of all time. So these white people are supporting, instead of saying being repulsed, "Oh, I don't want to go watch black people play because they are inferior people." These people are not glorifying, but you know, they are praising and with their attitudes and their money, praising what these black athletes can do. So that's what he was trying to say, I believe. And then he said, we have to give credit to the positive aspects of what America is doing and not focus on the negative aspects first. And this is a guy who, he's not, you know, this, as some people would say, an Uncle Tom or whatever. You look back at his history, he protested, he supported Muhammad Ali when Muhammad Ali refused to go to Vietnam when he was a conscientious objector to the war in Vietnam. And Muhammad Ali paid a big price because of it, and Jim Brown supported him for it. So, and he's been an activist, Jim Brown, you know, so we're not talking about this guy who just wants to be nice to the white guy. That's not him at all. And I would never have said anything like that to his face. I know he would have been upset. He was an intimidating figure, you know, a tall, strong fellow. So you wouldn't want to get him angry. That's how, you know, what a powerful presence he had as a person, and his mind too. He was a very, very strong person. And then he said, we're no longer in slavery. He said, we have self-determination, and we're in the greatest country in the world. And that's what we've been saying in these articles. Black people don't realize, you know, the opportunities that they're born into. You know, so many people would give an arm and a leg, almost literally, to have been born into this country and have the opportunity to live and work here. That's why they come flooding in from, you know, across the southern border. And black people are born into the country. They're born, they don't need a green card. They don't need to go through the whole immigration process, nothing. They're born into the greatest country on earth, and they have the opportunity to, you know, be somebody. You know, all these rap artists who become millionaires, they wouldn't become millionaires in Zaire. They wouldn't become millionaires in Kenya. They wouldn't become millionaires in Uganda. There's no chance in hell that they, a snowball's chance in hell that they would be able to make it in those places the way they can in America, or a basketball player becoming a multi-millionaire just for dribbling a ball. They wouldn't be able to do that anywhere else in the world except here, or a musician become a superstar, world-renowned superstar, and they can because they're born in America. And forget about sports or music or, you know, you can become, if you study and dedicate yourself, you can become a successful professional in this country. There's no more discrimination the way, in fact, what we have now is reverse discrimination. You know, if a black guy and a white guy file for a job and both have the exact same qualifications, chances are in these days that the black guy is going to get hired and not the white guy. So if anything, they have even more opportunities. So the thing is that instead of pursuing that, let me put it to you in perspective. I think I may have shared this with you before. There's a man called Cesar Millan who became the dog whisperer, you know, a guy who is famous for training dogs, and he has had his TV shows here in America. This guy was born in Mexico, and he came into the country illegally, I think. I don't know exactly what year, but it might have been 1980s, 1990s, I'm not sure. But I remember hearing him talking about that to a certain extent. He came, and for the first few days, he came with like a few dollars in his pocket. I mean, he came with nothing, literally, almost nothing. And he would sleep under an overpass. And there was one time that he took his son to the place, and I saw it, and it was like at the it's hard to explain, but there was this overpass, and underneath it, you know, there's this there was on the side this big slope, and at the top of the slope there was this very tiny very narrow flat surface. And that's where he slept at the top. And I said to myself, I would have never been able to sleep there because, you know, if you're sleeping and you roll over, then you would roll over and tumble down that slope and onto the highway below. But that's where he slept the first few nights that he was in America, with no money in his pocket. And he said, "I'm here. I can do anything." And he was saying to his son, "I can mow somebody's lawn. I can walk somebody's dog. I can do this. I can wash dishes." The world is an oyster. That's how he saw it. Even while sleeping under an overpass, the fact that he was in America was this like great opportunity, and he thrived and he was able. And now he's a legal citizen and so forth. And these are the people that deserve to be supported. And when you hear him talk about America, he sees it as opportunity. So he's different from the other Hispanics that you know don't appreciate this country for what it really is. He saw it, and that's why he thrived so much and became a very internationally successful person. I mean, he has his own TV show. He has this big. He came with nothing, and now he has this big farm or big land in somewhere in Southern California. But he trains dogs, and at one time he was living in Spain and doing the show from there. So he's become a successful, wealthy man through hard work and all that. But he didn't say, "Oh, I am discriminated against, and I'm living under an overpass. Oh, this is a filthy, racist country." He didn't take that attitude. And black people who are born with the opportunity, and they don't realize we're in the greatest country in the world, or used to be, and let's make a go of it. Let's make it happen, man. Come on. Instead of that, they just go limp and wait for somebody to take them to the promised land. They don't even want to swim, move their hands that they're being dragged across the Jordan. They just want to be somebody somehow dragging them across the river and to the other side. And they don't even, you got them to the other side, they wouldn't even get up to start walking into the promised land. And that's how lazy they are. Oh, that's the stereotype. No, that's the reality. That's the reality. And no one has said it, because everybody's afraid of criticizing. Because if you criticize, then you're a racist. No. If you really love black America, then you're going to tell black America what it needs to hear. Because if your brother is on drugs and is an addict, you tell him, you confront him, you do an intervention. You don't just pretend like he is okay if you really love him. But you know, white liberals don't understand that. White fascist liberals don't understand. They're too stupid. The white mentality of self-flagellation, like, "Oh, it's always my fault. It's always my fault. It's always my fault. Mea culpa, mea culpa, mea culpa." Slapping themselves with that, whipping themselves in the back. I have never seen a race of people do that, except for white people, especially white liberals. And speaking of that, I wanted to start talking a little bit about, you know, now that these two have passed away and these dates have come and gone, May 19th, May 24th, you know, what the landscape is. And let me share, for example, what happened in, this happened recently. There was this, I'm trying to find it here, sorry. There was this story about these kids. I think they were on some sort of tour of the Capitol building. I don't know why they would be there. I would never take kids to the Capitol building. What's the point? That place is cursed now because of what happened on January 6th and all that has come of that. It's not a place of the people anymore. And the thing is that there were these kids who were from some choir or something. So they stood there in some place inside the Capitol building, and they decided to sing the national anthem. And they were singing it, and like these little kids, cute kids, singing the national anthem. And then the police, the Capitol police, came and stopped them in the middle of the anthem. And said, "No, you can't continue." And then the guy who was, you know, who had taken the kids there said to the cops, "Well, what's wrong?" He said, "Oh, we don't allow demonstrations here." And this accounts this is like a demonstration, so you can't. No, we're not demonstrating. No, yeah, but the thing is that some people could be offended by this. And I always go, my goodness, this is the only country. I mean, literally, I'm not exaggerating. I think this is the only country on the face of the earth where there is where people of the country don't like their own anthem. I mean, you can go to the darkest places on earth. I mean, and you know, go to Mexico. Just go south next door to Mexico. Mexico is a corrupt, poor country full of. It's a horrible place to live in. Horrible place. It's poor, corrupt. It's evil, but you sing to them. You start playing the national anthem, and all of them will stand up and put their head, you know, hands on their hearts, and stand in solemn fervor, listening to the anthem until it ends. Their hearts beam with pride. Pride, and I go, pride over what? And I have said this before, even within Hispanics. You talk to Hispanics who are not Mexicans, especially the ones who live immediately south of Mexico, and they will tell you how arrogant Mexicans are. Arrogant. And they are so spiteful. They think of themselves as a superior breed of Hispanic. They feel themselves superior to the rest. They look down their noses at the rest of the people who live right below them. I'm not making this up. You can go ask anyone who knows about this, who's lived there or comes from there. You can go and ask them. That's the reality. They are arrogant as hell. And you go, what are these idiots proud of? Mexico, yes, it has had some measure of success in some things, in musically speaking, within Latin America. In terms of films, but back in the golden days of the 40s and 50s, when you had Cantinflas and Pedro Infante, I think was the name of some other guy. They had their own version of Hollywood, but you know, for the Hispanic world, and I think they still do a lot of telenovelas. So they do produce to a certain extent, but and musically speaking. In the 80s, they had some decent, 80s and 90s, some decent groups and so forth. But other than that, you know, you look at the state of the country, it's a disaster. What are you proud of? But yet they stand for their anthem. And it's the same thing throughout the world. This is the only country that I know of where people hate their anthem, where people burn their own flag. I mean, no other country does that. Mexicans don't do that. You try to burn a Mexican flag in a crowd, in a crowd of Mexicans, and that will be your last day on earth. I mean, really, you do that with the flag of some other country in their own country, they will lynch you. But this is the only country where that is praised. So, how can you say that the national anthem will offend you inside the Capitol building? But what I'm trying to get at is, first of all, I don't understand why those kids were there. Why you would think sing the anthem as if everything is okay. There is no... It's over, man. It's over. But regardless, the point is that now there's going to be this open attack on anyone who tries to speak any semblance of truth or try to act according to any truth. It's going to be more aggressive. And this also, you know, goes to show that self-flagellating attitude that white people have. To this day, I don't understand. You know, white people hate each other, hate themselves profoundly. And you don't see that in other races. See, other races destroy each other. You know, like black people killing black people, but all the time. And Hispanics are always raping and robbing and destroying each other. It's just their way of doing things. But they don't do it, how can I say, out of a philosophical hatred of their own race. You see what I'm saying? white people are the only people who do that, who philosophically say, I will hate white people. I will hate the white culture. The white man is the devil. The world would be a better place without white people. And they're white. And I go, my goodness, if the world would be a better place without white people, just go kill yourself. For crying out loud, kill yourself. Yeah, just get it over with. You're a pain in the butt. You don't belong in this world anymore. Just go kill yourself. Simple as that. Are you going to be consistent with what you believe in, or just shut the hell up? It's like all these people who keep saying we should give the land back to the Indians, the Amerindians, because it belongs to them. Well, if it belongs to them, what the hell are you doing here? Just get the hell out of here. Go back to Europe or wherever the hell you came, your ancestors came from. Don't tell me that like Spike Lee said, and you will see a quote of that, a clip of that in the video, in the interview with between Jim Brown and Brian Kilmeade, they put this short clip of Spike Lee saying, "The fabric of this country was built on slavery and robbing the Native Americans of their land. That's the essence and the fabric of our country." Idiot Spike Lee, multi-millionaire. Living the big life in the country, and then he goes and trashes the country and thinks that that's what the country's all about. You think, really? Are you that stupid, Spike Lee, to think that a country that's built on that alone would not stand? Because once slavery ended, why didn't the country collapse once slavery ended? If that's what it's built on, that's the fabric of it, then why did the country not fall apart? Economically, socially, whatever, when slavery ended. You stupid son of a bitch, idiot, worthless piece of trash. And then on top of that, he says it's built on the lands of Native Americans. Well, Spike, you have the money now. If this country, if this land belongs to the Amerindians, then it means it doesn't belong to you. Does it, brother? Does it belong to you? No, it doesn't. It belongs to them. Then you should give it back, like the song "Beds Are Burning" would say. Get the hell out of here. Go live in Kenya. Go live in Nigeria. Go live in the land that belongs to you, according to your own words. It's just this hypocrisy and self-flagellation and it's just contradiction. But the other thing that I wanted to mention is Ashley Babbitt's mother was arrested recently because she was being attacked by this. She was in the Capitol building. She keeps protesting and fighting. You know, her daughter was murdered, and she keeps fighting for justice and all that. And there was this protester who was just harassing her and saying F word. Ashley Babbitt. You imagine saying that to a mother of a daughter who died. How do you do that? This is what I hate about the white fascist liberal. The white fascist liberal has no compassion. He or she claims that they have compassion, that they care about people, that the conservatives are evil, racist, and have no heart and whatever, but they are the most vile and intolerant people on the face of the earth. And she was just harassing her and attacking and insulting you. You know, how do you do that to a mother who's grieving the death of her daughter? Even if you don't agree with how she died, how do you even go there? And use the F word. And then she was saying other things. It got to the point, and then she was coming at her, and Ashley Babbitt's mother just gave up at, you know, being nice, and then she went after her, and I think she was holding some offensive sign, if I'm not mistaken. I don't remember all the details. The thing is that they scuffled, and she pushed this evil person down and took her sign from her, and she was the one arrested for destruction of for taking away other people's property and for assault on the other person. So this is the environment we're in. So anybody who is anywhere near the truth is going to be attacked, and anyone who is evil is going to be protected. So even if you're the one assaulted, you're the one being attacked, and you defend yourself and you fight back, the system is now where you are the one who's going to be punished for protecting yourself, and the one who attacked you, who abused you, will go scot-free. And this is the environment we're in after May 19th and May 24th, and it's now full-blown. And the thing with the choir kids, Kevin McCarthy apparently found out about it and wrote a tweet saying, oh, that was shameful, blah, 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 and I'm going to invite them back and blah, 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 or something maybe to that effect, I'm not sure. But he didn't even go where he needed to go for this worthless piece of Irish Celtic trash. And there's a reason why I say that Irish Celtic trash, and if you read the postings on the website where this is, this recording will be posted, you will know what I mean, and we've kind of shared that before. The Irish have, there's a betrayal, kind of a betrayal spirit in the Celtic race. That's not why, it's not a coincidence that Bite Me is Irish, of Irish descent, if I'm not mistaken. And McCarthy is of Irish descent. And these are the two guys who worked out the deal that will cement the beginning of the destruction of the entire economy, American economy, for good. And it's been on its way down, but that was like the nail on the coffin, the nail on the coffin to seal the deal. It's two Irish guys going at it. And then on the other, and in the Senate, you had McCaca, Mitch McCaca, or McConnell, some people call him. And McConnell is a Scottish-Irish surname. So we have the Celtic thing here. We have a son of a bitch, thief, election thief. We have two hypocrites, one in McCarthy in the House and McConnell in the Senate. There's this Irish betrayal spirit. But the thing is, this Kevin McCarthy said about the kids who were stopped from singing the national anthem, that that was wrong. But he didn't go to the point of why is the national anthem offensive to anyone. And the weird thing is, I'm offended by a whole bunch of stuff every day. You know, I'm offended by the homosexual arrogance flag. Why should I be proud of people sodomizing each other? Why do I have to be proud of them? Why? Why does that have to be shoved in my face every single time? And I go by certain places where they have the transvestite flag, so now they have a version of the flag, of that flag that has the V thing or whatever, and it's symbolizing transvestites. And so sometimes I go by houses that have those flags. I cross to the other side of the street. I'm so offended by it, but you know, I wish I could just go up, and sometimes I am within reach of grabbing the flag and breaking it and destroying it. But I don't do that. Because as Jim Brown said, you know, we have our thoughts. We are living in a country, supposedly, where we can have our thoughts and our opinions. We are free to think that way. But I don't go around, calling the police. Well, it wouldn't work anyway, because the police would arrest me if I ever did that. But, I don't try to shut them down. Because my strategy against them is completely different. It's you change the environment. You change something else, then they will go away on their own. You change the environment and you will drive them out on their own. But that's another story. The thing is, I'm offended constantly, but that's not a problem. So if they sang the Black National Anthem in the Capitol building, I would be offended to high heaven. Offended. There was one time when I was in a park in New York, and they had this kind of event where they were playing. It's like a small amphitheater. I don't know how you call it. But the thing is that they had these public musical events in this park. It's Bryant Park in New York. They would play these musical groups, and some of them playing Hispanic music, which is offensive to me, but all I can do is just shut my ear. I don't go around shutting them down, I just, okay, it is what it is. You have to fight this fight on a different plane. But the thing is that one time they decided to play the Black National Anthem. And I said, what the hell? So what I did, I was unfortunately sitting right in front of the stage, but not in front, but, you know, facing it, you could say, but in the back, because I was sitting there just typing, doing my thing with my laptop. And then when that happened, when I heard that they were going to do that, what I did is I took a knee, you know, just like when they do the kneeling, when they hear the national anthem, I knelt down. But I not only knelt down, I turned my back to them. So I turned my back, and then I started waving my hand as if to say no. You know, I wanted them to see me waving and saying no. And I did that. And I was waiting for someone to get angry and come and attack me, but thankfully I was protected, and nothing happened. But the thing is, I was offended. But, you know, the weird thing is, how can you make something illegal or ban something because it offends someone? That makes no sense. That parameter for deciding what, because the irony is, I'm offended all the time by things that if I complain about, then they go, no, they have the right to do that. So that's the essence of it. Why are we offended? Why would the national anthem be wrong just because it offends someone? That's not the reason. There has to be a deeper reason. And the reason is that clearly the national anthem represents things that these people hate. And because it offends them, then they want to ban it. But if it didn't offend them and it offended somebody else, then it would be okay. But Kevin McCarthy never went there. So he just gave a very bland thing. And the thing is that, why didn't he confront the Capitol Police? Why is he so... he's the leader, the Speaker of the House, and he can't do a damn thing about this. Why can't he confront the Capitol Police? And why the heck can't he pass a bill? Why didn't he go and say, we will pass a bill that says that any cop who tries to stop someone singing the national anthem in the Capitol building will be suspended and put in prison. Why don't you pass a bill for that? Even if it gets knocked down, why don't you just give it a chance, you son of a bitch, if you really mean it. But it's never going to happen. It's all just smoke and mirrors. And the thing is, what I'm trying to say is there's an environment that's very negative. There was a pro-life guy. You can look that up on the Daily Signal, or if you do a search, pro-life man 73 viciously assaulted outside Planned Parenthood clinic, you will find the story. There was this 73-year-old man who was standing in Baltimore, sadly, you know, where I grew up, and I think he would normally go to that place to pray, just, I think, silently. I'm not sure how he prayed. He doesn't look like the type who would shout. 73-year-old guy. And he would just stand there and pray. And someone came out of the Planned Parenthood building and confronted him and got really angry and beat him up viciously. And you see the picture of him, and he's very badly bruised. And apparently this is not the first time. There was another incident, I think in Baltimore too, where another guy was beaten up so badly earlier that he was hospitalized, and he's still in the hospital. Recovering from the brutal beating just because he was outside of Planned Parenthood thing praying. That's the environment we're in right now. It's a very violent environment. And in Queens, there was this story recently of a guy who was walking around in somewhere in Queens, New York, at 2 a.m. in the morning, and then a Hispanic son of a bitch showed up and he was saying, give me money. And apparently he was like maybe on drugs or who knows what. And he had something in his hand that looked like a sharp object. It was at night, 2 a.m. in the morning. He's alone in the street. And the guy, the guy kept threatening him, very aggressive, viciously, very aggressive. And the guy then suddenly decided to lunge at him. as if just, you know, he was going to attack him. And he had, and it turns out it wasn't a knife what he had in his hand, it was a pen. But even with a pen, you know, you can inflict harm on someone. Because you can use the pen to stab the person, or, you know, put an eye out, who knows. So the guy, as he saw him lunging at him, and his name is Charles Foehner, I think, if I'm not mistaken, F-O-E-H-N-E-R, or something like that, Foehner. You look at that name, you know, he's not, I mean, he is, you know, already done having a name like that. If it was like, if his name was Deshaun Jackson, then you'd know he has a fighting chance, or Antoine James or something like that. But with a name like Charles Foehner, F-O-E-H-N-E-R, very Germanic, white-sounding name, you know he's done. The thing is that he pulled out a gun that he had, a 22 or something, a small pistol, and he shot the guy, and he killed him. And apparently he emptied the barrel on him and shot him 5 times until he died. And I get the feeling that what happened was the guy was lunging at him. He must have been in some sort of drug rage, I imagine. So he shot him, and the guy, you know, kept coming at him. So he shot him again. He kept coming at him. So he just finished him off, and he killed him. And he was arrested. He was charged, but as it turns out, the details is that he didn't have a license for the gun he had, and he had a whole bunch of guns in his house because they did a search warrant on him, and they found a whole bunch of guns in his house, and he only had licenses for a few of the guns and not for the whole thing. So he got charged, and he's now in jail. So yeah, there's a bit of a fault there with him and all the guns and the unlicensed gun. He had a license for 5 rifles, so if I took the time to take out a license for 5 rifles, I would have taken the time to get the license from that little gun. But apparently he was not charged for murder. He was charged for criminal possession of a weapon. But he's still in big trouble. And he said he had this big collection of guns because he likes to collect guns. He just didn't bother to register them. And that aside, what I'm trying to say is there's this environment where now if you get attacked, you are the one to be blamed, especially if you defend yourself. Just look at Daniel Penny, and the guy who choked to death, the other guy. And I know that what he did, we talked about it, his method was wrong, but we're talking about the same idea. Because it's like people trying, especially now, if you try to fight this evil with natural means, it's not going to work because the system is not on your side. And this is what this guy was doing. You know, he was using an unlicensed gun. He was trying to fight with natural means, not the way he was supposed to fight, if you get what I'm trying to say. The same thing happened with Daniel Penny. So there's this environment of darkness and violence, and it's going to grow and grow and grow. So now we're going to have this dynamic where liberals are going to attack conservatives. Conservatives are going to try to defend themselves by natural means, and then the system is going to uphold the liberal attacker and punish the conservative for defending himself. That's on the one hand. Then on the other hand, you have conservatives attacking the truth seekers. So the conservatives, are the ones who have half truths. That's what we've explained before. They are closer to the truth than liberals because liberals are not even in the neighborhood of truth. They don't even look for truth, so they are all the way over to, you know, who knows where, somewhere in the wilderness. The conservatives are near the truth, but they don't want to get too close to it, so they live in these half truths. So they now are going to be attacking, violently attacking people who are in the full truth. People, anyone who resembles anything close to the full truth, or that points out how far away from the truth they really are, they are going to be viciously attacked. So you have these two sides. So, and the one who doesn't win in this whole thing is, you know, the truth seekers, because the truth seekers are going to be attacked by the liberals and the conservatives. And the thing is, you can't fight with natural means anymore, because the system is just designed to completely punish you and obliterate you if you dare to do so. And that's what conservatives don't understand. They keep thinking they were living in the same America that they fantasize about. That's why Carrie Lake, the lady who lost the election, quote, lost the election in Arizona. She won, but she got cheated by this white trash Katie Hobbs, or whatever the name of the whore is, who will be burning in hell very soon. Cursed is she, cursed is her family, cursed is everything about her, and she will burn in hell pretty soon. The thing is that, and be tormented by it, and she's going to scream. She's going to be a pain in hell, because she's going to be screaming and tormented. She will never, for all of eternity, never stop complaining about the torment. That's how bitchy she is. The bitchiness in her will never go away. And she's going to be moaning and complaining for all of eternity. She's going to be annoying to be around. If you're in hell and you end up next to her, I feel sorry for you. The thing is that Carrie Lake, you know, said, I'm going to fight and I'm going to go to court and prove it. And we're gonna have victory, because I'm not gonna go down easily. I'm gonna go down swinging, and you know, she put up this big fight. Her lawsuit got thrown out. The judge just tossed it, and Carrie Lake is still, you know, convinced, and I think she might be trying to appeal the decision. Who knows what. But she doesn't get it. She doesn't get that the country is not the same anymore. It's over. And to think that you could have gone to, I mean, and the thing is, in the conservative websites, they kept saying, oh, she's like winning in the trial, like things are going well for her. And I said, no, because if she wins, that's going to be a validation of that conservatives are right about the country and the state of the country, that they can fight back and win. And the answer is no, they will never be allowed to win, because that's why Trump did not get back in the White House, because it would have been a validation to all these conservative idiots that they are doing things right, and that they don't need to change anything, and that all they need to do is continue doing the same thing. And that's why I knew, you know, no matter how positive all these headlines are, I know she is not going to win the lawsuit. And indeed, she did not. Not because she was wrong. I mean, she proved she evidenced a whole bunch of stuff. The validation of signatures was shoddy. They were validating like 100 like 30 signatures per minute. Or even faster than that, so they're not even looking at the signatures, and some of the signatures were just completely off, but they kept validating it, because obviously the system is rigged. And the judge said, well, there's nothing in the law that says you know, how to judge the validation of the signature. They went through the process of validating it or verifying the signatures, and that's all that counts. In other words, just go through the pantomime of pretending like you're validating just to fulfill the prerequisite of the law. But because the law doesn't say, oh, there's something that we can punish them for if the verification of signatures was shoddy. See, because the system is so poorly written. So Carrie Lake doesn't go, well, there's something wrong with the system. We have to rewrite the whole system. We can't have this fight at the state level. This should be a national thing with very clear objective standards. We can't have this be decided at the state level, because at the state level there's going to be state corruption. Katie Hobbs controls things there. She controlled the election process in Arizona. She, even though she was the candidate, she also controlled, she was in a position at that time to control the voting system. So that's all because the founding fathers left it that way. The states decide their own rules. But Carrie Lake is not going there. She's staying within her own mindset. She's getting, you know, pummeled and defeated. So that's what we're going to be seeing, this dynamic of conservatives trying to fight the liberals. The liberals are going to come even more aggressively against conservatives. And when conservatives keep fighting with natural means, the means they understand, they're going to get clobbered. And the system is going to come down hard on them and not on the people attacking them. That's what Ashley Babbitt is seeing. And I don't think she understands that. Sad as what happened to her and her daughter is, it really saddens my heart to know what she's going through. But I don't think she understands that the country is gone. And there's no way to fighting through natural means. The people who have the answer are the truth seekers, and they're the ones being ignored over and over and over again. And the ones who have the ideas that will change the country and transform this society. But they are going to not be attacked full blown. That's what May 24th. May 19th was a dark cloud in general over the country, visible. May 24th was when conservatives said, we are going to attack and destroy anyone who makes us look bad. And that's the country. It's a horrible country to live in. I hate living in this country. That's how it's become. Every single day is a sad weight. There is no peace. There is nothing. It's like I'm living in the third world. And even though it's not yet official, that's where we're going. The country will be dead in less than 4 months. A little over 3 months, and it will all be over. It's so sad. Thank you very much for listening.